You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. Today, we're happy to have as our guest Kevin Powers, author of The Yellowbirds, which was a finalist for the National Book Award and listed by the New York Times as one of the 10 best books of 2012. And if you look at the beginning of the book, I mean, there's scores of people who have praised this book, and Kevin's won numerous awards, and this is his first novel. And it seems like Kevin's first love, we'll ask him, is poetry. This is a tale of, and all I can call it is the War on Terror, because that's the only name that the war has. It's a poetic novel, rightfully so, Kevin served in the war from 2004 to 2005 and did see combat as a machine gunner. So welcome, Kevin, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm always curious about epigraphs, and yours are tough ones. The first one, which is derives the name of the novel from, reads, as much as I can read of it, "A yellow bird with a yellow bill was perched upon my windowsill. I lured him in with a piece of bread, and then I smashed his blanking head."
Right.
So, and that's a Marine cadence for marching, is that right?
Army, yeah.
Army.
Right.
Well, so, what gave rise to you naming the book that after that epigraph? Because it kind of rounds the book out almost.
Right. Well, I remember after I was out of the military, encountering that cadence. I don't remember the context exactly, but for the first time, I kind of recognized and was shocked by the actual content. What's actually being described in the cadence, and it was something that I'd sung very loudly, among a group of other, 18-year-olds, hundreds of times probably, never really recognizing exactly what was being described. So I was interested in that relationship to violence, the kind of callous relationship to violence that's represented in the cadence, and the way that that you so easily slip into that kind of relationship to violence. There's also, the kind of the idea of the bird, which appears as an image, throughout the book, and I have also always kind of been fascinated by, I wouldn't say quite phobic, but I have a bit of a bird thing that kind of freaked me out a little bit. There's something about the sort of the fragility of them as creatures, but also this obvious incredible capacity that they have for flight. So, when I was looking for a way, okay, how am I going to introduce the reader to the kind of thing that I'm interested in talking about and exploring in this book, in terms of being just very upfront about the kind of relationship to violence that was going to be described in the book. I thought that cadence sort of fulfilled that part of it, and then the other epigraph, I think, kind of indicates a different aspect of the story and what I'm interested in looking at.
Well, the first is so callous and uncivilized and uncaring towards death, almost wanting to do that to the bird, and the second seems at first like it's not nearly as nasty, but from Sir Thomas Browne, and says, "To be ignorant of evils to come and forgetful of evils past is a merciful provision in nature, whereby we digest the mixture of our few and evil days, and our delivered senses not replacing into cutting remembrances. Our sorrows are not kept raw by the edge of repetitions." And that's like, okay, thank God we can forget what we did, because if we didn't, there'd be this constant razor cutting into our flesh.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, those are sort of the two approaches I'm taking to the subject matter. One, wanting to be wanting to be honest and direct and acknowledge the kind of the rawness and of the experience of participating in violence and witnessing violence. And then on the other hand, also wanting the novel to be to provide an opportunity to reflect on the consequences of that kind of behavior, the consequences that it has in people's lives. So I thought, you know, those two epigraphs would sort of be complementary and trying to sort of give people an idea of what the novel was trying to do.
Well, it's interesting because both of those quotes made me think of George Santayana and, you know, the famous quote, "Those who do not remember the past are doomed to repeat it," which is kind of like your second one.
Right.
And the other thing he said is, you know, "Only the dead have seen the end of war." And that is kind of partially your theme in the book. And if you go back to your poem, "A Letter Composed During a Lull in the Fighting," what Bartle says, as quoted by maybe someone like Murph who wrote a letter home, is that war is just making little pieces of metal pass through each other, which is exactly what it is, and frames Bartle's kind of internal monologue regarding the war that keeps him semi-sane.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, one of the things that I wanted to look at was the different, you know, strategies or coping mechanism. However you want to kind of talk about it. Getting by, you know, and Bartle, I think, has different ways that he sort of tries to deal with the circumstances that he finds himself in, and he also sees other examples of the kind of compromises that people are willing to make to stay alive, to preserve different parts of their humanity, you know, so. Certainly something that I was conscious of.
You know, I read somewhere in one of your interviews about the name Bartle, and you said, you talked a little bit about how you got that name in your head. Why don't you tell our listeners, if you know, where that name came from? Because I have a theory about it.
So, you know, when you're, at least for me, when I'm trying to figure out names of characters, you know, I generally want it to be a name that a person would actually have. In that respect, Bartle is an actual surname. But I also felt like there was this kind of connection to, you know, to Melville, to Bartleby the Scrivener.
Yep.
And again, talking about strategies, ways of being in the world, you know, attempting to kind of, react and withdraw from you know, the difficulties that the world presents us with, and you know, that was just an important story for me. I remember, you know, the first time I read it when I was in high school, and you know, I just thought, well, you know, there's some kind of, maybe not overlap, but a bit of a parallel there in terms of how Bartle tries to deal with his environment. And so it was kind of just in terms of trying to find the name, it was sort of an inspiration, and it was resonant for me. So,
yes, the first thing I thought was Bartleby the Scrivener, and it's like one of my favorite books. And so many people don't like Melville because of Moby Dick, and they don't like that story either. But, you know, the idea of saying "I'd rather not"
right.
is what Bartle's trying to get to.
Yeah, exactly.
Unsuccessfully, exactly. Though. Partially successfully, but but yeah, and also the movie with what's his name? I've forgotten the guy's name. Have you seen the movie, The Bartleby the Scrivener?
No, I don't think I have.
It's great because it brings it to modern times. So I think you would identify with your book more by seeing the movie. And it's that really quirky guy that plays Bartleby, and he'll like spend the day in the office looking up at the air conditioning vent, just looking up at it all day long.
Right.
And his boss doesn't want to hurt his feelings, doesn't want to fire him, but doesn't know what to do with it.
Right.
And then that goes again, Bartle, goes like to the opening line of your novel, which is kind of not yet achieved, but almost achieved, the same status as Thomas Pynchon's opening line, which is "A screaming comes across the sky. It has happened before, but there is nothing to compare it now." compare it to now, whereas yours is the word try to kill us in the spring. And both of those, again, like take you out of the war and let you, well, you explain it, that first line. How did you come up with that, and what does it mean?
Right. Well, no, I mean, I think for, you know, the narrator of the novel, for Bartle, there's the sensation, and I think ultimately it's a kind of misinterpretation of the facts, but there's this idea that the war is something larger than the people who are participating in it, that it's something outside of their control, and it's, as an individual, I think he finds himself inside of this thing, and he feels utterly powerless to really do anything to control his own destiny, to do anything about it other than sort of just do his very best to kind of survive. And I think, you know, one of the things that he, by the end of the book, that he'll perhaps see that in a different light is this kind of recognition that, you know, that sort of the only, as human beings, as people, as citizens, you know, the only monster that is able to kill us is the one that we create ourselves. So it's actually, you know, it feels like this thing that's greater than the sum of its parts. But and in a lot of ways, I mean, there are so many variables and so many factors. It's understandable why he feels like it's got this life of its own, like it's its own thing, like it's feeding. And, so, you know, I wanted to start that way, just to try to give a sort of an immediate and direct access into, you know, first above everything else, Bartle's feeling of this kind of incredible powerlessness, and that there's this being inside of this this creature that's gone absolutely out of control.
Yeah, and it's funny because it's like the creature is the war. You know, it's not people killing each other. It's the war that tries to kill you.
Right, it's, and that's, you know, that's after all the, I think, the illusion that he's contending with, you know, and it's powerful because I think that's a that's a feeling that people often have, that there's this other thing happening.
You know, it's funny. In the past month, I've interviewed David Abrams, who wrote Fobbit.
Yeah, sure.
I've interviewed Phil Clay, who wrote Redeployment.
Right.
And now you. So, two questions. One, why do we write about war anyway? Why are you guys all writing about a war that, in my opinion, wasn't a war, because I never knew who the enemy actually was.
Right.
What do you think it is that drives, you know, drives authors to? I mean, I know there's so many times people say you're never as alive as the moment that you're in a war with your buddies, watching your buddy get killed, killing other people. That you'll never have that feeling of life again,
right,
which is so strange. But how does that give rise to this? What are you trying to tell us, and why are you trying to tell us this?
Yeah, no, and I really admire both of those.
Me too.
Those guys and both of those books. You know, I think what it is in my case, and in the case of the story that I wrote, and really in the case of John Bartle too, it's trying to find a way where you can make sense of your own story, right? You can kind of make sense of what happened to you, or attempt to anyway. And I think particularly for Bartle, for my narrator, he has this incredible sense of guilt and shame and regret and so forth. And I think he's trying to kind of like trace the pieces one by one and figure out what exactly he's responsible for. what is he, you know, who is he in debt to? You know, this kind of, he's like, kind of got this, like, psychological or spiritual, like, deficit that he's running. And yeah. I think he's trying to figure out, like, how he can pay it back. And to do that, he has to understand, you know, what he did, what happened. And I think that kind of thing is probably true for most veterans who write. It's like, I want to figure this thing out. I mean, it's a, you know, maybe it's an impossible task to have it figured out, but I think the effort to understand, to figure out, okay, you know, you realize that that these experiences are going to contribute to the person that you are for the rest of your life, but it also becomes important to ask the question, you know, am I going to be defined by these experiences? Am I going to be limited by the experiences? Can I be both, you know, somebody who's gone to war and somebody who, you know, is many other things, a music lover, a fisherman, I mean, you know, whatever, X, Y, Z. So I think it's just really a process of exploring your place in a world that, that in a lot of ways you sort of are trying to re-recognize. You're trying to redefine where and who you are, and I think probably you know, in my case, and I would imagine in David and Phil's cases, probably they've always been people who used writing to ask those kinds of questions, and you know, certainly true for me.
Yeah, but it, you know, if you're a fisherman or if you work in a tower and you have a boss and you sit at a desk and you write reports, or you go out and fly to Hong Kong and try to sell titanium or widgets or whatever, mm-hmm. you don't have that same accessibility. And what's funny, as I was looking at combat deaths, so in World War II, there were 291,000 American deaths. In the Civil War, there were 212,000. World War One was 53,000. Vietnam was 47,000. Korea was 33,000. The Revolutionary War was 8,000.
Right.
And the War on Terror was 5,281. And you have these books, you know, A Farewell to Arms, From Here to Eternity, Catch 22, The Naked and the Dead, Slaughterhouse 5, A Red Badge of Courage. And it seems to me as it doesn't really make any difference the number of casualties. What it is that you have access to something in war that you don't have in any other aspect of human life.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, I think there is the very basic principle of trying to communicate something to another person who doesn't necessarily understand it, right?
So, yeah.
And a lot of that is trying to find a way out of, you know, I think one of the consequences of war, I know, is pretty pretty common and beginning to be sort of widely recognized and acknowledged, is that it can cause a kind of sensation of being isolated in those who have experienced it. So, in a lot of ways, you know, writing is communication, and you're talking and you're sharing these stories, and you're you know, you're not constantly leaving it, you know, as a kind of internal operation in your own mind.
Yeah.
And I think there's in many cases, a curiosity and a desire on the part of people who haven't had this experience to have some kind of window into what it might be like. And
well, that's the other part of it. It's like
right.
that. It's like that. You know, how many Marines does it take, you know, to screw in a light bulb? And, you know, the answer is, you wouldn't know, you weren't there.
Right.
And, yeah, there is this kind of band of brothers thing going on. But it's really interesting because, you know, you have a lot of characters in the book, but basically it's kind of like a Greek tragedy. You have Bartle, you have Murph, and you have Sterling.
Right.
And there's just the three of them. And it's really funny because, you know, one could be considered pure evil, one could be considered pure innocence, and then Bartle can be this ambivalent admixture of both. But you make the reader really work hard. And then the fourth thing, of course, is Bartle's kind of inner monologue.
Right.
And it's structured much like a poem, almost like, you know, like a Paradise Lost kind of thing. But then you make the reader work really hard because, same as Bartle, you know, you kind of like, you're drawn to Sterling, and Bartle loves him and hates him, and I think the reader does too. And then with Murphy, yeah, you love him because he's an innocent, but he's also an idiot.
Right.
And then Bartle, what is Bartle? Is he the worst of them? Is he the best of them? You know, you make the reader work really hard, which I think is the mark of a really good novel.
Well, I appreciate that very much. Yeah, and I mean, one of the things that I'm not disputing your assessment of the characters. That's very, very well describes kind of how I think about them as well. But also that at various points in their story, that they behave, you know, different from the way that you expect them to. There are moments when Sterling shows kind of compassion. There are moments when Murphy is sort of more effective as a soldier than Bartle. And yeah, I wanted to kind of show the sort of, you know, the fluidity of that kind of behavior, but that Bartle sort of, again, as we talked about earlier, he's seeing these strategies of how do I get out of this, that kind of thing.
You know, it's funny, again, for the reader, the scene where Sterling is in the brothel and treats that woman the way he treats her, it's like then where you really think, I hate this guy so much. But then part of you is thinking, wait a minute, I kind of understand, kind of, why he's doing it. And it makes it very difficult for you in your own mind, you know, to recognize those things in yourself, because everyone has that particular breaking point. It's just
a question
of where it is on the bell curve.
Right, absolutely, yeah. And I mean, you know, it's, you know, I think that's kind of the challenge that is presented to us as writers and also as readers, is to be able to recognize ourselves in each of the characters. Not necessarily, you know, not to agree or support the things that he does, but to say, like, okay, I mean, I this guy's essentially destroyed his capacity for kind of moral behavior, or, you know, he's just not equipped to kind of handle a very basic interaction like that anymore. And you know, trying to yeah, I mean, I think it's the appropriate response is that, like, that's horrible, but maybe I can see why this guy is being so horrible.
Well, it's kind of bookended too, because, you know, that's the moment where you really hate him the most, and he's not really a person in a lot of ways.
That's true. Yeah.
And then at the end, what happens to him? It's almost as if it's, I don't know, not Christ-like, but you know, it does bookend it, because at the very end, you know, you hear from Bartle, you know, what's happened, and it's kind of like, you know, I've done all these things, there's only one option left.
Right, yeah. No, and I think at some point in the book, you know, you probably recognize how it's going to end for Sterling.
I don't know. You know what? I didn't think he would ever be able to reflect that totally on his past actions.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I mean, I guess my thinking was that if he ever got to a point where he was able to look at his behavior and actions, then you would see that. That's what I was kind of show.
Right.
To show is that when he's in a position where he's not able to focus solely on the immediate task at hand, that he could potentially be in big trouble.
It's like a fall from grace, and then, you know, I've always thought in the Christian small c way, you know, like If at the very end, after a life like of, who's the poet, Villain?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's like if at the very last you confess and you reform, even in your last breath, then in Christianity, then you'll meet Jesus in heaven in an hour.
Right.
And it's almost like that's what he did.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think in a way he's looking for that same thing, the same thing that Bartle's looking for, some kind of way of accepting a degree of responsibility, accountability.
Yeah, but what they can't find is absolution.
That's right. Yeah. That's right.
That's why everything, and that's any war. I mean, that's the thing, is it could be 2 casualties or 2 million casualties. And what happens in it, you know, I've said this before, I said it to both authors, we have a very thin veneer of civilization.
Right.
And I use the metaphor of like when you get creme brulee for dessert, you know, it has this crust on top and you can tap it and it's hard, but if you tap it a little harder, you get all this mushy stuff underneath.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah.
Well, go ahead. Yeah. And what I was going to say was I tried to get Abrams to say it was a horrible war, shouldn't have happened. He wouldn't do it, even though his book kind of said that.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to get Phil Clay to say that, and he wouldn't say it. And I don't know why. So if I asked you, was it a meaningless exercise that served no purpose? And when you say support our troops, the only way you can really support them is by bringing them back. Would you agree with that?
Specifically with regard to Iraq, I would, yeah. I mean, I think Afghanistan requires requires a bit more discussion. I think I see when people talk about justification for going there, I'm able to be swayed somewhat by that. On the other hand, Iraq, the place where I fought, was, of course, it was a mistake, and it was horrible. You think of the thousands of Americans who were killed, and the tens of thousands of Iraqis who were killed, who had their homes destroyed. Calling it, for me, anything but a tragic mistake wouldn't be true. Now, I realize it's incredibly complex, and obviously that within that there were, you know, there were possibilities for small moments of kindness and for people to do things that did have meaning, whether it was on a small scale or in a particular context. But for me, looking at it as a whole, no, it was absolutely a terrible, tragic mistake.
One of Phil Clay's story kind of goes there, one of his stories, but it also is the one that's most often compared to Catch-22.
Mm.
Well, here's the thing with me. I mean, these are the things I don't know about Iraq. I don't know what a terrorist is. I know that sometimes we are. I don't know what an evildoer is. I don't even know what a spider hole is. I don't know what it means when you say bring someone to justice. I don't know what the coalition of the willing is. All I know is weapons of mass destruction. The United States has all of them.
Mm.
I know no Iraqis were involved in 9/11, and I know there weren't any al-Qaeda in Iraq until the war.
Right.
So it's like, and I know that George Bush wanted to go after Saddam Hussein because he wanted to kill his daddy. And I know all his advisors said, hey, why not Iraq? That doesn't make any sense. So I know all those things, or at least I think those things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, the good war, World War II, you didn't have to worry about any of that. But in Iraq, that's what an intelligent person would worry about and what you apparently worried about.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, it became pretty apparent to me when I was there, and I was among the second group of soldiers to be in Iraq. So there was the initial force that went in and invaded, and of course they were told we're looking for weapons of mass destruction. And by the time my group got there, a very large group, you know, it was pretty obvious that things weren't exactly the way that we had been told they would be. So yeah, no, I mean, I don't really have much difficulty in talking about Iraq as a mistake. I think generally it's pretty well kind of just accepted, right? I mean, in the country that we shouldn't have done it. But I get when people want to make sure, like, you know, I wasn't privy to the conversations that you had with David and Phil, but I'm going to guess that they wanted to make sure that, you know, they acknowledge the kind of complexity of the situation and that kind of thing. But and I get that. But you know, for me, I kind of am comfortable getting that part of the conversation out of the way. Yes, obviously it was a mistake, and then there are, of course, other aspects of the experience that we can talk about, the complexity, the difficulty of one of the things that I really was trying to focus on in the story is how do you, how do you react to this kind of naive effort to do something good, and fail? What happens to you when you want to be good and fail, and you aren't presented with the opportunity to do good? You're presented with the opposite. That's sort of the way I think about it a little bit.
Well, it's funny because, you know, Phil Clay's opening line of his first story is, you know, we shot dogs.
Right, right.
And it's kind of like the same as you. It's like, then he goes home and there's his dog who has to be put down. And it's the same action, but in an entire... Well, yeah, and you do, as he does, you do a really good job, especially with Bartle, of coming back. And people generally don't... You're forgotten when you come back. And,
oh, yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome, he's like the poster boy for it. And, you know, in World War II, you came back, everyone loved you, but you still have the same problems.
Right.
But now you have Effexor and Paxil, and you have Xanax, and you have all these things that can kind of hide everything in a kind of cloud or mist.
Right.
But it's almost as if you're more, even more than Clay, kind of emphasizing the fact that coming back is just as difficult, maybe even, well, actually, yes, more difficult than being there.
Yeah, for sure. And in terms of the, you know, the problems as understood by, you know, people at large, the nation at large, I think it is a bigger problem. You know, people get that you're in physical danger when you're in war. But I think we're still kind of chipping away at this idea that, you know, you come home, you know, they some brass band plays a song, and then you're fine, right? I mean, I think we're steadily getting rid of that idea and introducing the other ideas that, no, there's still difficulties. You're still in danger. It's just danger of a different variety. And that was really, you know, something like half of The Yellow Birds is set after the narrator is by, you know, safe, right? I mean, he's of course not, but he's returned to the United States. He's not in any immediate physical danger, but half of the book is takes place in that setting, and I wanted to make sure that I was, you know, not just acknowledging that part of the experience, but emphasizing it and showing the, you know, hoping I could find some kind of drama in that, and let a reader who maybe didn't understand that kind of danger is real, to show them, you know, how that isolation happens. What are the kind of consequences of the experience of being in the war and taking those experiences home with you, because you can't just, you know, you can't just turn them in when you turn in your rifle, you know.
Yeah, and it's like the other thing is that you emphasize, and people forget that these are 18-year-old kids, you know.
Children, right?
Yeah, children. Yeah. My nephews are 18 and 21, and I can't even imagine. It would obviously change, obviously, as, you know, it's it's silly to say otherwise, changed our entire life. And the other thing that people forget is that when you come back and your mom picks you up, just like your mom used to pick you up, you go home and there's your bedroom with the same posters on the wall of Star Wars or or The Incredibles or whatever you had on the wall before. And it's impossible to reconcile those two.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. Absolutely true. And, you know, one of the ways that we can think about it is to, you know, say that most people who end up in a war are very young. They're being asked to process a lifetime's worth of experience, of, you know, of fear, of grief, of loss. And they're being asked to process a lifetime's worth of experience with equipment that isn't even fully developed yet, you know? I was talking to somebody the other day, and they were telling me that the particular part of the brain that remains kind of undeveloped when you're like 18, 19, 20, the part that's still developing is the part that's kind of responsible for patience, like impulse control, ability to kind of be reflective, and I'm certainly not an expert in that area, but that kind of jives with my experience of being 18. You know, just sort of, and then it's like, okay, yeah, and now deal with this lifetime's worth of emotional experience. And it's difficult. It's obviously very difficult for Bartle, the narrator, and difficult for Sterling too, and Murphy, and I think probably difficult for a lot of the men and women that are coming back.
Yeah, it's funny. You underscore really nicely the fact that, you know, if you're just reading the book and you don't bring it out, you think of Sterling as being like, 40 years old. This old man that's leading him around, telling him what to do. He's been all over the place. He's been there.
Right.
But he's not. He's just a kid, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what's, it's really amazing to me that, and then, of course, what happens if you have a lieutenant or someone who is still just a kid and doesn't have the capability to lead?
Right.
But then you have Sterling who does, and he's under that. That's always, I don't. How does that work out in war? I mean, did you encounter that?
Yeah, no. I mean, well, influence is always not always dependent on
rank.
On rank, right? Yeah. So, and I think we see that kind of stuff happen where you hear stories of people kind of starting their own little various groups and extracurricular activities of the worst possible kind, and that stuff can be dangerous. I mean, so leadership is very important, and it takes the same forms that it takes everywhere else in the world, but just kind of with different stakes,
Yeah, it's almost like this is a horrible comparison, but it's almost like watching an episode of The Office or something. Where the guy who runs things is totally incompetent.
No, I think that's incompetence in wartime is a very, very, very dangerous thing.
Well, so I know that I was going to ask you, is this an autobiographical novel? But it kind of really isn't, is it?
It's not. I mean, okay, so if you look at the particulars of what these characters do, then no, it's not autobiographical at all. If you look at it kind of through the lens of what these characters think about, what they're afraid of, the kind of feeling of the feelings that they experience when they return home, then certainly, I mean, in a lot of ways, there are parallels to the things that I thought about, the things that I was afraid of, the things that I felt when I returned home, the confusion and that sort of thing. That aligns in a way with my own experience. But no, in terms of the actual narrative, no, it. Obviously, when you're describing and so forth, yeah, you draw on your own experience. You know, what does this look like? What does that feel like? But no, it's quite different from mine in its particulars. Thankfully, I'm very, very happy about that.
So it's funny because poetry, which is your first love, I mean, that poem that I excerpted from with regard to what war is, it gave me a feeling again of how poetry, in a different way, can compress all the things you wrote in your book.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel that way as well?
I think so, yeah. There's something, for me, the great thing about reading poetry is the immediacy with which it can kind of transmit that energy or that emotion. It seems to me at times that poetry, it's almost as if it's not even asking necessarily for your comprehension.
Right.
Almost in a way is asking for your kind of apprehension, if you take my meaning. So there's something about it that I think it is able to Charles Olson, talk about like that transfer of energy or whatever that can happen with a poem. And I think, yeah, for me, I'm hoping to transfer that energy to the reader. And when I pick up a book of poems, I'm hoping to receive that energy. And the great thing about, the great thing about the novel in particular and stories are its immersive qualities, that there is a sort of kind of world that gets built. I've always, those two forms have been the forms that I've always turned to, since I was introduced to them, really, as a kind of early teenager, 12-year-old, whatever. For me, it's always been the poem and the novel. I don't know why. I mean, I do, of course, there are short stories I admire, but and I like to read nonfiction, but those two forms have been the ones that I have always responded to most powerfully.
It's really funny because, like, the shortest poem in the world, William Carlos Williams, so much depends upon a red wheelbarrow glazed with rainwater beside the white chickens. I mean, I read that, and it's like, okay, that explains the entire universe.
Right.
And I have no idea why it does.
Yeah, and that's good, and that's kind of the point, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's about it's taking a kind of oblique angle to things, and for me, it's always been a really productive way of interacting with the world by reading poets.
It's funny too. I have an independent bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop. Your book is prominently displayed, and I probably think it'll be a book club prediction. I mean, I predict it will be a book club selection. But I have a poetry section, but no one ever goes there. And it's like, in today's world, it's just, I don't know what it is, but people, like Marianne Moore, a poem should not mean but be. It's like, people don't get that anymore, I don't think, or very few people.
I think, and this has come up a bunch over the last couple of weeks with different people. I think part of it has to do with the fact that the way that poetry is introduced to us when we're young readers. Now, I know it's not, they're excellent teachers. My English teachers were great. I was excited by poetry. But I think I was excited by it organically. I would have been excited by it anywhere. But I think for a lot of people, it's presented first as a difficult thing, right? It's presented first as something you're going to have a hard time understanding. And when it's presented like that, of course people turn away from it, right? You're in 9th or 10th grade, and you're like, oh, this is something that's going to be really hard, or
well, yeah. As you're 9th or 10th grade, they ask, you're reading the Rime of the Ancient Mariner,
right?
But then the way you get to it, I think, is a lot of it is through Robert Frost.
Yeah, sure.
Because you can understand that, whether it's stopping by woods on a snowy evening or whether it's the road less taken, you can understand that and you know what it means.
Right, right. Yeah, so I think there's, you know, I think part of it is just there's something in the way that it's presented that, you know, if people's first impression is that it's something to be resisted, and that can last for a long time. And it wasn't, I mean, relatively speaking, it wasn't all that long ago that poetry would have been in every home in America. So I don't know. I'm keeping the faith with the poetry. It means a lot to me. I know there are people out there, you know, like you're saying, for whom it means a lot too. But yeah, it's occasionally a bummer.
Well, it's tough for me to get anybody to read. You know, I'm an independent bookstore. I'm not going to get rich.
I'm
trying to fill a niche that's very small and have an enormous amount of competition.
Yeah.
But, you know, like with stuff like flash fiction now, maybe poetry is more accessible. If you read a short story that's three lines long and understand it.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, and this, you know, I think these kinds of things probably ebb and flow a little bit. And, you know, I imagine, you know, poetry is at the very minimum thousands of years old, right? So I think it's going to be around for a while. So I try to be optimistic about it. But yeah, it's you know, yeah, you're right. I mean, poetry is facing challenges. Yeah. Writing that aspires to be art is certainly facing challenges too, you know. So it's but you know, just got to keep at it.
The thing about it is that you can kind of define what a book is, whether it's fiction, nonfiction, what genre it's in. Is it a good book? Is it a bad book? That kind of thing. But how would you even how do you define poetry? What is poetry?
Well, I've always thought the you know, I know it's a pretty broad definition, but was it Berryman that said a poet is a man or a woman alone in the room with the English language? I think I've always thought that was an acceptable definition. You know, you see what happens. It's unpredictable. It's so accepting. It, you know, it can take so many forms and so many shapes, and yeah, it's malleable in that way. But yeah, it's the product of a man or a woman alone in a room with the English language. I mean, that's kind of, it can be so many different things.
Right. And, you know, sometimes, well, and your book is poetic in that sense, I think, and that's what makes it intriguing to a lot of people, I believe. Well, so I've kept you for almost 50 minutes, but to end it along the lines of what we're talking about, which way are you going now? Is your next work going to be in another novel? Is it going to be a volume of poetry, or both?
Well, I have a collection of poetry that's coming out April 1st.
Oh, okay.
So I'm excited about that, and I'm at work on another novel now. It's pretty early in the process of working on it, but it's set just after the American Civil War is over in Virginia, which is of course where I grew up. And I'm really interested in looking at that period of history, particularly the fact that we as a nation at that point, I think there was a real opportunity for there to be justice and equality, like actual justice and equality in our country in a way that we'd never had before. And something happened. Something happened in those first few months and years that caused us to have another century and a half of inequality and injustice. So I'm right now writing a story where I'm hoping I can explore what happened.
So it's like this. It could have been this way, but and you're after the butt, right?
I'm after the butt, yeah. I mean, you know, and it's of course, it's got to be about people first, you know, and characters and the choices that they make. But I'm hoping some of those kind of thematic questions I have, I'll be able to explore. So I'm excited about it. I'm excited to get to work on it and dive all the way in. And I'm excited. I'm going to have a couple of opportunities to talk about the poetry that's coming out, and I'm excited about that as well. So,
yeah, next week I interview Philip Myers, who wrote The Sun.
Yeah, sure.
Which is a sprawling, you know, I don't read that kind of stuff, the sprawling Western epic, almost like an intelligent Dallas. And, but yeah, what's great about the show is I read stuff I wouldn't read normally a lot.
Right.
And then I say, and then I find out I really like it a lot, which I never thought I would like something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, he's actually, Philip's a good friend of mine.
Really?
And, yeah, really, I really, really admire that book a lot. I think it's an incredible accomplishment.
It's really hard to look at a book and see that it has like 70-some chapters.
Right, exactly.
But he does like you do. It's like... every chapter, you know, he goes, it's one character, the next chapter is another character. And you do the same kind of thing in your book, too.
Right.
Going backwards and forwards. Well, anyway, yeah, so if it's coming out April 1st, maybe we can talk to your publicist again, and maybe we can talk about that book.
I really enjoyed this. I would look forward to that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed it. Sorry if I talked too much.
No. This was great. Thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
So, Kevin Powers, the book is The Yellow Birds. It's hard to read because there's a lot of nasty stuff that goes on in Iraq. You know, the things that had to happen, little kids getting killed by mistake, soldiers who were too young to understand exposing themselves to the possibility or the actuality of death. And it is written very poetically, and it does set things up as if it was a Greek tragedy with good, evil, something in between, like a Greek chorus. And afterwards, you know, not like many books, is that right? You think about it. You just don't put it down and move on to the next thing. You do think about it. You think about the uselessness of all of it, but you also think about what it does to people and how it gives rise to this ability to convey something that would otherwise not be conveyed. It's not enough to justify what happened or what you did, but it's enough to create literature that explains what man is, what man could be, and the worst that man is. And it's funny, there's no women either. So anyway, that was great. Next week on the Avid Reader. Oh, yeah, I'll tell you. So like what we're doing now is what we're doing now is revamping our entire web presence. So we have a new website that'll be live this week, next week, whatever. And, you know, we'll have an Instagram feed. We'll have a Twitter feed. I'll be live. We may have this show and other things streaming live on YouTube, because now you can stream live on YouTube. We'll be on Pinterest, Facebook, Yelp. We'll have contests. Have all kinds of new things, and I'm not sure whether it's going to monetize the bookstore to any extent, but it'll get us out there. We'll have our blog, we'll have our newsletter, we'll have ebooks for sale, and pretty much any of the 400,000-500,000 books that are now in print, you'll be able to buy from us as well. And then, of course, my collection of used and rare books and signed first editions that are laying over all over my house and in our warehouse. So. No, I forgot what I was going to say. Oh, next week. Next week on The Avid Reader, we will be speaking with Charles Balfour about his great, great novel, The Paris Architect. So it's about occupied France. It's about Nazis. It's about Jews. It's about collaborators with the Germans. It's about the French Resistance. It's about really kind souls, real devils, beautiful women and mistresses, hiding places. And then primarily architecture and how it informs the entire book. It's an excellent book. I don't want to say easy read, but you fly through it. I read it in one sitting, as I did with this one. And I think that you'll really enjoy it. I think listen next week. And if you haven't already read it, I think after you listen to the show, you'll definitely want to. So thanks as always, and for me being long-winded, and you know, I talk too much to I talk too much to let the author really get in everything he wants to say. But I think we really did get along well with Kevin Powers, and I'm just so thankful that they're willing to appear. And you know, he's writing this book of poetry. Poetry is something you guys should be reading, and comes out April 1st, and hopefully we'll get him back here and we can talk about that as well. So thanks again. I will talk to you guys next week, and it's a pleasure having you as my audience. And please come by and see us at Wellington Square Bookshop, just off the Downingtown Interchange of the Turnpike in the Eagleview community, and we'll treat you to a cup of coffee, and you'll get 20% off of all bestsellers and whatever else I can do to get you in there. Talk to you soon.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.